Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
El mundo está loco. Lo malo es que los que siempre pagan el pato son los niños.
¿Algo está ocurriendo en esta isla?
Parecía como si todos los niños de la isla se hubiesen despertado.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Damn kids, get off my lawn.
Also this week is Professor Nicholas Schlegel.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming on. This week we are talking about Who Can Kill a Child? Directed by Narciso Ibanez Serrador, the 1976 film tells the story of Tom and Evelyn, two tourists who travel to an island off the coast of Spain, only to find that it's been taken over by murderous children who have killed almost all of the adults on the island and terrorize our protagonists. So we all know that the 1970s were rife with these kind of like things gone wild movies. It was kind of like how the 50s had all the giant stuff like ants and teenagers and all that. Those were grown to huge size via radiation. In the 1970s, it was kind of more like maybe like the environment was fighting back and taking out the humans. So rather than giant ants, it was swarms of ants. Rather than giant bunnies, it was swarms of bunnies. Well, actually, they were pretty big too. And then you had bears, spiders, and now kids. So we're very fortunate this week to have Nick along for the ride because he's a bit of an expert when it comes to Spanish cinema, and in particular, Spanish horror. So Nick, how did you come to Spanish horror? Why is that your kind of niche?
It really goes back to my grandparents who had immigrated into the States in the 20s from Europe, from Hungary. So they're Hungarian immigrants, and they, you know, live largely the immigrant experience. And then at one point, my grandfather's career became international yet again, and so he was traveling back and forth to Europe in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and eventually gone into business for himself. And he started doing a lot of business in Spain. And in the 1970s, on the summer and summer vacations, we would go as a family and spend time in Spain. My grandfather had bought an apartment in the Canary Islands, which is just off the coast of Morocco, in Las Palmas. So we had this sort of like beautiful paradise, this lovely apartment in this unbelievable setting. And so my love affair with Spain began at a really early age, sort of a bicultural upbringing between here and Spain. I was actually speaking Spanish before I spoke English, because my first trip, the first summer over there, was when I was two and just learning how to speak. And flash forward to when I was working on my PhD, my advisor had said, what are you thinking about in terms of a dissertation? And I threw out a bunch of ideas, and one of them was, well, I'd love to sort of fuse together my love of travel, and in particular, my travel to Europe and Spain, with my love of horror movies, kind of like the Reese's peanut butter, right? Chocolate and peanut butter, two tastes that go great together here, and get some Spanish horror going. And she said, well, what's significant about that? And I explained to her there was a big gap in scholarship, that there very little had been written about it in English, very little. And the more I didn't have to go much further than that. She's like, it sounds great, go after it. And that's really, that was what, around 2004, 2005. And Mike, that's really kind of when it all began for me. So that's kind of how I came to Spanish horror. I combined my love of travel with my love of cinema, and in particular horror. And then, of course, the Spanish horror film is a kind of neglected body of scholarship, but certainly not amongst fans, as you guys know. The more people see of it, the more people are like, wow, this is really pretty cool. I didn't know about this body of work, and so on.
being a guy who worked in a cult video store, and I've watched a lot of different things. Off the top of my head, I can't really think of a lot of Spanish horror directors, except maybe Jess Franco, who's like the big name that kind of comes to mind. Why do you think that Spanish horror is kind of overlooked when we talk about horror from other European markets, say like Italy, where I could name you probably 5 to 10 different directors?
Like I said a second ago, it was neglected because there wasn't a lot being written about it, that sort of like two-way relationship between reviews, criticism, scholarship, history, film history, because people weren't reading much about it or seeing much saturation about Spanish horror in general. It wasn't really on the map, so to speak. It certainly wasn't anywhere targeted like a bullseye, like, say, you know, the English Gothic cinema or the Italian Gothic cinema. Like you said, you could easily come up with a list of many Italian filmmakers. And I think but the more specific and I think the more proper answer to your question would be that a good portion, at least half of the Spanish films, were co-productions. They weren't immediately recognizable as a cultural product of Spain. It wasn't until the sort of like mid to later phases of the Spanish horror boom where you got to see certain filmmakers put stamps of sort of national character and even express national identity through the apparatus of cinema in these horror films. They begin as very mimetic. They're copying, you know, U.S. horror films, exploitation films, British horror films, as you said, the Italian horror cinema. And they're just entering into the market kind of the image I like to bring up. I conjure is sort of like a horse standing on all four legs for the first time. You know, they're just trying to sort of get set up in the genre, which was, you know, very much in vogue at that time. But how do they go about making horror films that are expressly Spanish in character isn't something we get until later. And as you can see in the film we'll be discussing in this episode, there's lots of Spanish things going on.
One of the things I wanted to ask you on this, and maybe this has to do with sort of Spanish cinema in total, is that, you know, the history of Spain, especially in that period, when we talk about post-World War II period, I mean, it was under Franco until he passed away in the mid-70s. And there's a lot of discussion when we talk about post-World War II German cinema, where it took, you know, 20 years. I mean, you really don't have quality German cinema until you get to the German New Wave, basically, of Fassbinder and all them in the late 60s. So do you find that Franco, in a way, led to an issue with them just having a film industry and having, as you were saying, a direct stamp on the product that was coming out?
That's a big part of the book, really. I mean, that the first sort of 25% of the book is devoted to tracing those steps, really. It was, you know, the Spanish Civil War took place from 36 to 39. And of course, this is when Franco acceded to power and sunk Spain's economy. Well, of course, they had leveraged their reputation by allying with the Axis powers during World War II. But after World War II, they had sunk Spain's economy. Franco sunk Spain's economy into a really horribly ill-conceived autarky, which is sort of an economic closing. The borders closed to all manners of trade and became a self sort of like sustaining nation. And this really bad economic mismanagement led to what the Spaniards called the years of hunger, Los Años del Hambre. And it was really, really, really bad period. That 10 years from roughly 39 to 50, you know, I go into a lot of detail in that the book, because there was a tremendous amount of starvation. There was a tremendous amount of fleeing to various Latin American countries like Mexico and Argentina, for example. And it was just completely and utterly a failed regime. And then after that, what Franco did was really quite smart. He decided to sort of court the United States by offering to set up military installations in Spain. And it was sort of like a very conscious attempt to sort of like shake hands. The United States was all that thrilled about this idea at first. Eisenhower, you know, it was not exactly. In fact, they had called for us to sort of like sever diplomatic relations with Spain during that autarky. But they put together a feasibility study, guys, called Operation Drumbeat, which was to sort of measure what kind of commensurate agreement could be put together there. And they came around, you know, and said this will probably be worthwhile. And at that time, then Franco launched into this new plan of economic stability they rolled out in the 50s. And at the center of that was the idea that they needed to leverage the thing about Spain that made it the most attractive, and that was tourism. So they decided basically to implement, they called it Operation Exterior Propaganda. And the idea was to import tons of foreign culture and foreign visitors, and then, and consequently foreign dollars. And as you guys know, tourism, which becomes one of the central issues in tonight's film, tourism becomes the main engine through which Spain's economy continues to flourish and grow. And by the 1950s and 60s, they, with a trained workforce, which was being, you know, trained somewhat by people like Samuel Bronston, who came in and made sort of like historical epics for Spain, like El Cid, for example. They learned very quickly and entered into sort of like the era of cinema politics that was really quite fruitful for them. But the real point here underneath all of this is the fact that under Franco's dictatorship, no ideologically subversive genres were sanctioned. So it was like musicals, war films, sword and sandal type stuff, sort of like, you know, the Italian peplums, things like that. Spain would do their versions of that. Films that glorified their own past, like El Cid, and of course stuff with girls. But certainly nothing overtly political or latently political, and no horror whatsoever. Horror was deemed sort of like unfit for consumption in Spain. And that's kind of in the linear and sort of simplified way the route they took from their civil war up until the late 1960s, when kind of the jig was up, because importing all those foreign dollars and foreign visitors and foreign culture meant importing other attitudes, guys, you know, other ideas about what life should be. You know, if the three of us are going to a film in Madrid in 1967, say to go see Bonnie and Clyde or something like that, and we see a very different cut of it, we're going to comment to our friends, you know, we saw that in L.A. last week, and that's a very different film, what you guys just watched. And of course, the Spaniards would be like, what are you talking about? Of course, it's the same film. And you'd say, no, it's been edited. It's been cut. And so eventually, the idea was that with Franco's tether to life sort of like waning, you know, he was getting quite ill, quite sick. It became the butt of jokes on Saturday Night Live and so on and so forth. You know, Chevy Chase talking about
our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Francisco Franco is still dead.
This notion that there was this once very strong despot and the idea of despotism was really dying. It was kind of shameful when you think about it, that this prominent Western European country that for a good 100 years was the most powerful in the world, along with the Britain, was living under a military dictatorship, a fascist form of government in the middle of the 20th century, was almost shameful.
What kind of signaled that horror was an acceptable form of expression, and how did that kind of evolve?
The idea was they would take some baby steps. They said, you know, the cinema was definitely a very popular form of entertainment, particularly in societies like this where there is a rigid form of government. And they did have a very, very strong board of censorship that was operated by civil servants and Catholic priests. So there's a lot of issues there. And the general idea was that they were not turning the profits that they had been turning in previous eras. And when they looked around at what the current genres were that were popular and profitable, as the three of us all know, the 60s was a really transformative decade for horror. You know, looking at the major the major avatars of the business, from sort of, say, Psycho and the Hammer cycle forward up into the exploitation that was going on here. So you had that wonderful sort of milieu of like Corman films and Hammer films and Herschel Gordon Lewis films and Hitchcock, you know, and Peeping Tom and all this, you know, and then by the end of the decade, Night of the Living Dead and so on and so forth. You had all these wonderful changes going on in horror, and people talking about it and people going to it, and violence saturating, you know, Europe and the United States to such a degree in the 1960s that they decided, well, perhaps we should enter into this too. And of course, this was La Marca del Hombre Lobo, the Paul Naschy film that the Spanish government actually got behind and stamped their approval. They said, fine. And not only that, let's do this in 70 mil. Let's do it in vibrant color. Let's get sets. Let's get, you know, good locations. Let's get a decent international cast. Let's go all out on this and see what kind of money we can make. By this point, the cat's totally out of the bag. You know, it's sort of like your form of a military dictatorship's not going to cut it any longer. You know, you've been importing so much foreign culture that it's, you know, at times caught up with you. What signaled it was the fact that no one was going to see the films that they were making. They weren't. It's analogous to what happened to Hollywood in the late 1960s. And the death of each studio, signaled first with Paramount when they were bought by Gulf Western. They became so tender and ripe that they were gobbled up by another entity. And it's analogous to what was going on in Spain at the same time, is that the films just weren't turning profits or attracting audiences. They were out of touch with the commonplace everyday lives of its own people.
Who Can Kill a Child comes out 76, being filmed probably 75. Franco dies November 75. What else is kind of going on in the country? What helped bring about Who Can Kill a Child?
The evolution of the genre is quite interesting in the case of Spain. Like sort of alluded to earlier, the initial efforts, they're made by essentially by fans, people like Franco, people like Paul Naschy, who, in particular Naschy, who was such a fanatic of the universal horror cycle of the 1930s and 40s, that it was, you know, very, very mimetic. The first sort of era of Spanish horror is dominated by this idea that basically that it's derivative and somehow repetitive of the universal cycle. And they're dealing with largely with a lot of supernatural elements here. You know, vampires, you know, Dracula, the Wolfman, the Mummy, and stuff like that, dealing primarily with the supernatural, just as the horror genre did here in the United States. You know, when we entered into it, we entered into the supernatural sort of side of the ledger. And then it wasn't until maybe a decade later when, as we all know, Val Lewton's RKO unit explored more psychological themes. And then, of course, we get into the 1950s, color, Technicolor, deluxe color, 1960s, which we just talked about a few minutes ago. I point this out to you guys because Spain takes that same trajectory, but in a very concentrated short bit of time. So they go from working directly with the supernatural, then taking more interesting getting more interesting with it. For example, with the Armando de Osorio Blind Dead quartet of films, which, you know, resurrect a very strong Iberian icon, that of the Templar zombie knights. And they give us four films where they can rape and pillage and cause all sorts of harm across the Iberian landscape. And of course, there's films like The Horror Express, you know, Eugenio Martín's Horror Express, which is a very, very continental, almost Hammer-like entry, not the least of which because it has Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Telly Savalas in it. And many other films, too, that Naschy is starting to get quite interesting during this era, too. For a while, he continues to make these, you know, he continues to sort of like live his fantasy of becoming Lon Chaney Jr. and Lon Chaney Sr. You know, he starts off as Chaney Jr. in those Wolfman films with Waldemar Daninsky and the 12 films he would go on to make as Waldemar Daninsky, his Polish nobleman werewolf, which was an ode to Lon Chaney. And by like 1974, he's doing a film like A Hunchback of the Morgue. So he's trying on Lon Chaney Sr.'s pants now. And by God, that is an incredibly twisted. Do you guys know this film?
I've never seen it, no.
Oh my goodness, Rob?
No.
Jeez, you know, the Hunchback of the Morgue. I have to wholeheartedly recommend that to listeners. That is a That is a film in which, you know, every trope, every possible trope, and then some, is sort of loaded into the cart. And for some strange reason, cinematically, it just works. But by God, what a nutty film that is. And eventually, we get into, Mike, you said around 75, 76, what's going on. I've tried to sort of quickly trace that evolution for you. By then, we're getting into films that are directly engaging in some fashion, expressly Spanish characteristics. They're bringing in things from Spain's own history, whether it be the tradition of Feísmo, from feo meaning ugly, was a sort of artistic tendency to bring in a sort of like a Goya-esque disfigurement into the aesthetic of the film, which is built in, or to bring in the Trendisimo, which is also very a similar Spanish literary analog, which emphasizes sort of very strange non-narrative plot and storylines that are very typical of post-World War II non-narrative cinema in Europe, avant-garde cinema, and the fusing of the two of them together. And eventually we get into two or three films that are seen as sort of like almost anti-tourist in their sentiment. Eugenio Martin does a film called Una Bella para el Diablo, which is A Candle for the Devil. Are either of you familiar with that one by chance?
I'll be honest. This is the first Spanish horror that I've seen.
Oh, okay, great. So. Even all the better. That one is I interviewed Eugenio in Madrid, and we talked quite a bit about that film. Now, that's an interesting one simply because it's about two sexually repressed sort of like Catholic spinsters that run an inn. And Judy Geeson is sort of this like topless sunbathing, very 60s mod English tourist that comes in and sort of like accidental. I'm putting quote marks around accidental death ensues. And it's really an incredible film. But laced throughout it, you know, threaded into its narrative is sort of this strange sort of anti-tourist sentiment, which you can see really explicitly take form in Who Can Kill a Child. By the time we get to films like Who Can Kill a Child, then you're really getting into some things that we can discuss when we talk about the film in greater depth that are expressly Spanish or, you know, and really engage directly with what's going on with Spain at that time. And a lot of the repressed steam and sort of overflowing broth comes to boil with Spain, and you can see all this seep into their cinema. And particularly in films like A Candle for the Devil and Who Can Kill a Child.
So we kind of gave you carte blanche when we asked you to come on the show. And I said, okay, pick one movie to talk about, which I know was kind of, it killed you a little bit inside, I'm sure. Why Who Can Kill a Child? What set that apart for you?
I'm a big fan of the director of Serradors. You know, his first real cinematic foray into it was La Residencia, you know, the House That Screamed, which is have either of you seen that one by chance? Though I'm curious because that one has really gotten some traction lately.
I'm going to disappoint you because really the only Spanish horror films that I've ever seen are a few of the Jess Franco films, most of which I don't think were even filmed in Spain. I think he was doing stuff in Germany. The only thing I know about Spanish cinema is that Buñuel ran afoul of Franco with Verdiana. So
sure.
Yeah, so I'm a huge Buñuel fan. If you listen, you'll know that. And now you have to take two drinks. So there you go.
Yes. So I did watch one of the Tombs of the Blind Dead films. I forgot. I did watch that before we went to ZombieCon a few weeks ago. But otherwise, was House of the Psychotic Women, was that a Spanish film?
Yes, it is. That's Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, which is Paul Naschy, which has, of course, its Spanish title as well. And that's representative of a small but, you know, interesting Spanish giallo cycle. So yes, that's a great example. It is a Spanish film.
That and Who Can Kill a Child, you now know the full extent of my Spanish genre history.
Well, getting back to what we talked about a second ago, Mike, I would say that I chose it because I'm a big fan of the director. His film, The Residence, or The House That Screamed, I'm sure would appeal to both of you. It's beautiful Euro horror. It's just such a striking film. Lily Palmer is in it, and she's outstanding. She's wonderful in it. And in fact, her appearance in the film lends a stateliness to it. It's clearly a bigger brother, a bigger sister to films like Psycho and Peeping Tom. Certainly there's a strong Hitchcockian presence, The House That Screamed, that would later clearly go on to influence people like Dario Argento. So when you look at The House That Screamed, it's clear that films like Deep Red and Suspiria owe a debt to The House That Screamed. And Serrador is clearly sort of like, you know, he's aping to some degree Hitchcock's Psycho, particularly with its relationship to the gaze and looking relations in general between spectator and film and the camera lens. However, Who Can Kill a Child is also very Hitchcockian in the sense that it's a film that deals with the rupture of common everyday life, very much like Hitchcock's The Birds, which is a rupturing of the commonplace everyday scenario by an unexplainable event, namely the attack of the and the sheer volume and numbers of psychotic birds flying around. So, and you have a very similar thing going on in Who Can Kill a Child, which is the sort of inexplicable rage of these children against their of the adults in their lives. It's a rupture, again, a sort of cinematic rupture of the commonplace everyday experience. And I also chose it because it's a film that truly unhinged my jaw. There's one scene in particular. My jaw just dropped when I first saw that film. I thought, God, Cronenberg must have watched this. It's just, the film really just spoke to me on so many different levels that I could not help but choose it as, you know what, if you're not all that familiar with Spanish cinema, this is a film that's later in the cycle, but it is certainly well worth your time.
When I posted on Facebook that I was watching this recently, I actually had one of our listeners wrote and said, I couldn't make it through the opening credits. And I totally can see why that is, because the opening credits are this harrowing look at, I don't want to say just child abuse, but it's the abuse of humans, but especially children around the world, with this just horrific footage of atrocities all the way from the genocide in Germany to civil wars in Africa and poverty in India and wars in Korea and Vietnam, and just all of these awful, awful images of children. And in between each one of those, you get this like creepy as hell, like child chorus that's singing this kind of like happy little ditty as we go through here. And I really had no idea what I was in for. Like I had no idea what Who Can Kill a Child was even about when I'm watching this. And just that like first, 5 minutes of it, I'm like, what the fuck did Nick do to me with this thing? It was just,
I agree with you. I want to add in on this, cause I've said this several times on the show, is I have no problem watching the most horrific, violent films and just, right, it doesn't bother me. But like I've said before, show me real violence, show me footage of the concentration camps, show me war and death and famine and all that stuff. That's disturbing. And that first, 5 to 10 minutes is very disturbing. As a matter of fact, watching it, I said to myself, I go, whoever picked this up for an American release, I will bet you they cut that first 10 minutes off, because we see a snippet of that later in the film when they happen to be in a store and there's part of this playing on TV. It's like some sort of documentary or something. So I'm like, an American distributor of this film would totally just cut that first 5 minutes right off the front of the film.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I wish I knew the answer to that, but I mean, I think it's a safe bet that was, you know, just to save like running time and fit more bills into a double or triple feature, as well as later on television, I'm sure it was cut. It is truly one of the most bizarre opening credit sequences, I'd say, in cinema history. I mean, to have, like, you know, in like ticker tape fashion, statistics of all the children sort of like slaughtered, both physically and psychologically from war to war throughout the 20th century, and to chronicle that in gruesome detail with with all that footage. It's insane. It's truly insane.
The one thing that I thought about with the opening is that what it does for the viewer, that I think if it was removed, the one thing that it does for the viewer is it almost gets us to a point that when the kids start attacking the adults on the island, it's almost like, here's the reason why. It's they've been so mistreated that he wants you to side with them almost. And then the fact that, like, one of the first images we get of the kids is I remember this girl, like, beating this old man with, like, a broom handle or something. Yeah. And you're almost like, okay, so the adults have led to the slaughter throughout the 20th century of all these, you know, like you were saying, in abuse and everything. So that it's almost like he wants you to side with the kids when that turn happens. And I don't know if it would be as strong an implied bit if you were to take those opening credits off, no matter how crazy they are in that way.
You know, I think you're absolutely right, Rob. The title card and the central question of the film, ¿Quién puede matar a un niño?, asks not only of the film's characters, but us, the spectators, who can kill a child. And I think that credit sequence, which is so harrowing, sets up the tone and the mood for the rest of the film, which is also, I think, as challenging as the credit sequence. It's probably not coincidental that one of Mike's friends on Facebook said that they couldn't sit through it, because it really sets up what you're in store for the rest of the film. And I think I'd like to comment a bit later about your point to the children modeling the behavior after the adults, because that's I think that's really at the heart of the film, and probably one of the reasons why I think this most recent remake I didn't found it as resonating as powerful as the original.
You know what it also kind of reminds me of, and I would say it's a loose connection, is we get in, I don't believe it was before this, I think it was a little bit after, is the Italian horror with them trying to place people in actual situations. I mean, the opening almost reminded me of like a Mondo Cane or something like that idea, which had already been out in the 60s. But what I'm talking about is something like maybe like a Cannibal Holocaust or something like that, where they're trying to use reality in some way to bring horror out of this and build a story around and build this sort of credibility around the film, because obviously it's a fiction feature, but to use real things to boost sort of the horror contingent of what will happen later is something I think that's more European than what we were seeing in American horror films at the time. I mean, outside of maybe like you were talking about Night of the Living Dead or something like that, like trying to use like news, you know, like here's a news report about what's going on to try and heighten the reality of the obviously not real concept of the film.
He's kind of asking us, you know, right from the beginning to consider and query what constitutes evil in the 20th century. You know, when you couple that with, like you said, this European exploitation aesthetic via, say, some of the Italian cannibal zombie films, things like that, with this sort of literary melange of like Lord of the Flies and John Wyndham's Village of the Damned and aspects of, like I said, The Birds, it becomes a really potent fusion, really, you know, that aesthetic married to those thematic material, all set within the sunny Mediterranean. It's like, what the hell am I watching here? I mean, it really the film hits you quite literally over the head right from the get-go with those crazy credits, and then seduces you into the world of these two tourists, right? These two English tourists. Spain was a country that was inundated with tourism by, you know, the Scandinavian, German, and British, and U.S. primarily, you know. I mean, these were the most often seen tourists who owned property in Spain and would go there all the time. And for me, the Tom and Elvin, the coupling of the two of them, really sets the story up beautifully with this unplanned pregnancy that they have and sort of like becomes a little thing that they're discussing. And so they got this whole first 25 minutes that we see in the film that is not, incidentally, in the remake. And I think that's where it loses for me. Some of the impact is lost. I don't really care so much about the couple in the remake, although I think it's a fine job acting from both of them, as I do about Tom and Evelyn, because we're brought into their lives as they visit Benavis, right? And you know it's inundated with tourists. They can't actually get a place for the evening, so the gentleman at the hotel tells them where they can go and stay with the woman, and then she tells them where they can go and get a boat, and then they spend the night having drinks and watching the fireworks, and it's them sort of like trying to deal with this what at first seems to be some sort of like calamitous to some degree, which is, oh, we didn't plan for this third kid, you know, how's this going to affect our marriage, how's this going to affect our finances. And, you know, the sort of like unspoken threat there is abortion, right? Do we want to have it? Sets up a powerful scene later on.
It was very good that we got a break after that credits scene. You know, it's like we had this like psychic bomb go off for us, and our ears are still going to be ringing for a long time after that opening. And I thought, again, that it was going to like just keep hitting us right away when, you know, one of the first things that happens in the film is that there's a woman's body that kind of washes up on shore at this very busy beach. And I was like, oh my God, you know, it's going to be one thing after another. But then we did get this kind of break where we follow Tom and Evelyn and we get to know them. And really, they kind of become our saviors a little bit because they are normal and we are away from this horrible footage of the opening credits, and there's not murder going on for them. It just seems like they're this kind of, for lack of a better term, island of normalcy that we are visiting with them. And I think that's what helps make everything that goes on after they arrive at the island even more horrific, is because we have given them so much of our sympathies and we really have bought into their story, and they just seem like a nice couple. Like, we don't get a whole lot of fighting between the two of them.
Clearly still in love, yeah.
And it's really nice because normally in most American films, there's usually like the couple who's on the rocks, and they use the horror of the events that are going on to, you know, bring them back together. Whereas with this, they are together at the beginning, and then we get to see how, you know, they fight against the world. And it's nice that they are a team for the majority of this film.
It's great. You know, it's like most of Serador's work, the story and plot are simple, but the themes that are much more complex. And you're right, they're still very clearly much in love with each other. And they are ultimately open to that pregnancy. There's that scene in the room where they're staying where he comes and sits next to her. And they share the Fellini story, right? When they're talking about La Dolce Vita, right? And it's clear that they want this child and that and everything's going to be very, very hunky-dory, and it all resonates. There's a bit of hubris with Tom, right? I mean, he's dying to go to this Almanzora, the island that's 4 hours away. And they say, well, there's no doctor there. And then he's like, ego kicks in and he's like, well, I'm almost a doctor. You know, I'm a biologist and I do research and stuff like that. And, you know, he keeps pushing to go to this place, even though she wants to stay in Benavis. It's all about him going to Almanzora. And yeah. And of course, like you said, when we get to this island, everything seems okay. But this is sort of like where it becomes the Birds. You know, we have this sort of this rupture into the sort of normal everyday patterns of life, and good God Almighty, it takes a turn and things quickly deteriorate.
I found it kind of ironic. You know, I had to look up what Almanzora meant, and it comes from the Arabic for place of victory. And I was like, oh, that's pretty coincidental. I like too that, you know, things start happening fairly quickly on the island, but there is a nice kind of build up with that. And it is this, you know, they really, like, we enter into horror territory pretty quickly as far as like this kind of abandoned place, and we know that bad things are going to happen and all this. But, you know, the one thing I always say when it comes to a movie like Halloween, which comes out just a few years after this, is the most horrifying moment of Halloween is when you see Michael Myers in the daytime. There's something so horrific about seeing bad things happen in the true light of day. And that's when most of the bad stuff happens in this film. It doesn't get any more real than that. It's not like things are jumping out from the shadows. We are getting everything right there under the beautiful Mediterranean sky.
Right. And that is kind of where I was alluding in the first half of the show, that we could start to sort of discuss expressly Spanish things here. So it's like from a trope standpoint, the conventions of the genre. In fact, today in my office earlier, a colleague of mine, Shanna, walked in and she's like, "What are you watching?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just looking at a few scenes from this movie we're going to be discussing tonight on the projection booth." And, you know, I paused it and said, "How would you describe this film?" And you know, she's like, "Well, it looks like it's just like a romantic comedy set in the Mediterranean or something like that, you know, or a romantic film." Or and of course, you're right, Mike. I mean, that is the trick of some of the later Spanish works, which was, what does Spanish horror look like? If it's derivative of other international acceptable and profitable models early in its stages, then as it starts to experiment in the mid stages, by the end we get to what I consider to be perfection. And that's one of the reasons I think I highly recommended this film to you guys, was because this is sort of like, not only is it a wonderful example of Spanish horror for the reasons you've just pointed out, but I really haven't encountered a horror film, Spanish or otherwise, that accomplishes some of the things this film does. When the child aborts its mother, you know, in the film's sort of most abject and disturbing moment, you know, I lost my shit. I was just like, what is this movie? And it derailed me so much. I was in shock when she hemorrhages and dies right in front of him. And of course, there's no medical doctor on the island. And of course, he was warned of that beforehand. He passes out from sheer exhaustion and shock. And I'll tell you what, guys, I practically did myself the first time I watched it.
Obviously, the tourism angle is very Spanish. Was there something at the time, as Franco was dead or dying when this was being made, of a concern about youth in Spain? And maybe this is where this whole thing about the kids and all that's coming from. Because when we talk about other places that have had more sort of violent overthrows, like when we talk about Romania in the late 80s, that was led by the youth. We talk about somewhere like Iran right now, where over 50% of the country is people under the age of 30. Was there something in Spain at the time where people were like, okay, well, the old order has died. We've got to figure out what we're going to do. We're no longer under this dictator, and maybe we can't trust the youth. Are there some themes of, you know, what was going on in Spanish history at the moment as to why he would come up with such an idea for a film?
Absolutely. I think it's a marriage between two of the things that you just spoke of. I think that the film, first of all, it was the youth of Spain that became its mappers, both at the level of government as well as cinematically speaking. It was the Spanish youth that became, to employ a navigational term, its mappers, because of course Spain being a nation of navigators, they were trying to navigate modernity with unsure footing. And so that's very much a part of it, coupled with Serrador's sensibility as a filmmaker. It was, you know, the Spanish Civil War is mentioned in the film, and my book argues, it takes as its core central thesis, that the boom in Spanish horror, because you have to understand that there's once Spain actually, we talked about earlier, when they actually say, sure, go ahead and make, you know, horror movies, it's okay. Which, by the way, you know, in and of itself is sort of like a first for a Western, a nation, particularly one that was so powerful at one point in its history. You know, there's like really no other example of a country saying, you may make science fiction films now, you know, or you may make, you know, detective films now. I mean, this was a big deal for them to actually say, you can make horror films now. I mean, they actually gave their blessing and almost like a stamp and said, you may make horror movies now. So when you marry this idea of the youth of Spain being its intended mappers for a sort of Jeffersonian constitution, a new democracy, with Serrador's sort of like misgivings about the Spanish Civil War, and his sensibility and warnings not for history not explicitly to repeat itself, to not scar these children as well, Yeah, I think you're really onto something there, Rob. I think that's really at the heart of the film. Earlier, I said that I wanted to comment about, there's actually a communication theory, a cognitive and psychological theory called social learning theory, the Bobo doll theory, which suggests that children model and imitate their behaviors based upon what they see. And it's almost like Who Can Kill a Child is a walking example of what later would become this theory, which is it starts off with this credit sequence we talked about, and we won't get into the ending. But we see that clearly children are, you know, they're modeling their behavior about what they're seeing on the news every day. There's just no end to war. There's just war, 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 war. It's never ending. There's always war going on. And the sociobiologists say that's simply because we're human beings. We've been violent for X amount of thousands of years and supposedly civilized by laws that will punish our transgressions by either killing us or sending us to prison. So we keep our shit together, basically. And they say, you know, it's in our DNA. We're violent. You know, we build weapons and we kill each other in more sophisticated weapons. And it's very interesting when you think about that in relationship to the ambitions of the film. Sarador often commented that he felt it was a little too heavy-handed and that he would have rather appended the film with that stuff rather than begin it. But like we've talked about tonight, I think it works pretty well. It is a slap to the face. I mean, it knocks you upside the head, that's for sure.
I think it's very effective, too, that really, once we get into things, there are only a handful of deaths that we see. This is not, you know, the children have already run wild once Tom and Evelyn get to this island. You know, there are just a few stragglers left, and they walk into this arena of where the children are already victorious, you know. And so I think it is actually more effective just seeing a handful of people go than seeing body upon body upon body falling. And for me, you know, I know what the most disturbing image of the movie is for you, but for me, the most disturbing image is we've already seen children at play on the mainland, and then we get them here on the island, and we see them at play again. And their use of the old man as a piñata was really what got me going when I was watching this. But what I really like, too, is that so much of the violence in this film is implied violence. Rob had mentioned the guy who is being beaten by that little girl. You don't really see her hitting him. You see the implications of it, but you don't see it, the cane or the broom handle or whatever, hitting the guy repeatedly. And I like that implication throughout the film. It's tricky, and it did, you know, more than the birds, it reminded me kind of Psycho, you know, how you never see the knife enter the body. It's that same thing. We just imply this level of violence, and it just makes it even worse, I think, because we're picturing it all in our heads rather than seeing it on the screen.
With them getting at the island and then getting to the hotel and all that stuff, it has this kind of like post-apocalyptic feel to me at times, where it's like the society that was there has been wiped away, and these people from the previous society have come in, and now they've got to deal with this new setup, which to me by the mid-70s, you know, not only was I thinking, okay, well, the end of the dictatorship in Spain, and maybe this is sort of a warning that, you know, the youth are coming up and they could, you know, follow what we've done before, or they could be just as horrible. But also I was thinking, because this is the mid-70s, and we had talked about before on the show about the idea of the rise of cults, the rise of the counterculture in the West, the revolutions of 68 in France and things like that. And I also had this image in my head that maybe this was the place where the communes won. This was the place where the Manson family types won. And now the normal people have come in to visit, and then they get slaughtered out. So it's almost like, okay, so you wanted your hippie utopia. This is what happens when your hippie utopia takes over. That was the other thing I was thinking of, because that obviously would have been in the mind of people living in that era.
There's the moment where we meet one of the survivors, and he's the one who actually gives us the title for the film, you know, Who Can Kill a Child? This, you know, this very good question that we have, that we had answered in the opening credits, because obviously a lot of people can kill a child, but, you know, he is very heartfelt, just like, you know, who could do this? Who could do this horrible thing? And he's the one who his daughter comes back in and calls him out, basically, and it just is like, you know, Daddy, you got to come with me, and leads him off to his death. And there's really, I think he knows what he is going to be undergoing. Tom and Evelyn definitely do, but he is just so resigned to it. And that's another, like, I literally got a chill when I was watching that scene, because it was just so creepy. And just to your point, Rob, it was that whole idea of, you know, the youth have come up and they're taking, you know, that whole, like, never trust anyone over 30. They're really, you know, taking it to the full limit of it.
The other thing I was thinking also with the title is, if you look at the opening, it's all about mass exterminations, right? Mm-hmm. It's all villages, or, you know, the Jews or whatever. And the idea that we can be more violent towards a group. So think about the title as Who Can Kill a Child, right? One. Because a lot of the times that you see in this film, the interaction is just one kid and them, and it's much harder for them to attack one kid because of the you know, they're relating to a persona as opposed to relating to an entire group. Like, you often find that people are much more willing to either pass laws or kill or do whatever to an entire group. But when they know one person and they have to deal with them face to face, it's much harder for them to just try to exterminate one person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. For me, the film is definitely, it's a great example of one of the core themes that I explore in the book, and kind of like reaffirms assertions that I made earlier on in the book. I think through the investigation process regarding national trauma, that's my argument, is I talk about that, how the Spanish horror boom is kind of a result of psychic repression and of a fascist government and all of the aftermath of the Civil War, essentially. That, yeah, when the Spaniards sort of like were – when the Civil War was over, there was never any real way to deal with the aftermath of it. Those repressions were ultimately, I think, later fueled in all sorts of things, but eventually found sort of like an expression in the cinema of the late 60s, where they were finally allowed to do this. And so I think that the films in these sheer overwhelming numbers were kind of like utilized collectively as part of a new constitutional framework. Which accepted, you know, its past, but forged or tried to forge a new and like more prosperous future. And one could look at Who Can Kill a Child as definitely sort of a warning to not repeat the mistakes of the past, to not get into wars, because otherwise the cycle of violence will continually perpetuate, as it indeed has proven to do century after century after century. We don't seem to learn from our mistakes.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after these important messages.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
All right, I'm here with Mike White and Rob St. Mary to tell you a little bit about the projection booth.
All right, Reverend Scott, politics, the church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blather.
Is there anyone's coattails that you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy who fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and all around often terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I've been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
Just the other day, got a 1-star review on iTunes.
Well, that's 1-star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. Whew. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Do you like movies? Do you like beards? Do you bathe in raw meat? Do you dance under the fiery sky of Ra, daisies threaded through your man-chest vein? Foolish question. Yes, we all do. But do you do it listening to the podcast from the After Movie Diner? If not, then you're missing out, and you may or may not spend eternity in insufferable torment, wedged between Simon Cowell and Piers Morgan in an elevator that smells of death. The After Movie Diner is a website dedicated to movies. New, old, large, small, and of every genre. There are written reviews, interviews with the famous and interesting, and a weekly podcast with comedy, reviews, interviews, a variety of fascinating and flatulent co-hosts, and music to tap your toe to. So why aren't you on board? Get there or miss out on the podcasting sensation of a generation. One that feels like being slightly tongued by an over-enthusiastic Cocker Spaniel. Find us on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, TalkShoe, and over at aftermoviediner.com.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women and men and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other.coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Kids killed that old man.
They tied him up. They slaughtered him.
Empezamos a oír unas voces.
All the kids woke up at the same time last night, and then they all started attacking all the adults.
We have to get out of here.
And we're talking about Who Can Kill a Child, Spanish horror film from the mid-1970s. And now you have credible horror movies from the 1970s, and you can't really have a honest-to-God credible horror movie from the 1970s unless there is some sort of remake of it, right? Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween. Well, fear not, my good friends. This film is no exception. There was an obligatory remake in 2012 called Come Out and Play. Now, guys, how do you see Come Out and Play comparing to the earlier film?
Nick, you've already brought up a few things that are different about the 2012 film versus the 76 film. And most startlingly, it's that opening that we don't get in the 2012 film, which, even though it was horrible to watch the 76 opening without it, it really becomes such a different movie. It becomes almost a little bit more by the numbers, as it were. And just, I didn't necessarily see much of a difference in the 2012 remake. But so many things were kind of beat for beat throughout so much of it that I really kept asking myself, why did they feel it was necessary to do this? And with the removal of some of the more horrific things, such as those opening credits, it just seemed to really kind of lose its punch. I don't know. What did you think?
Why was it necessary to do a remake? Come on now.
Asked and answered, right. Yeah, I agree with Mike 5,000%. It's like, I was not offended by this remake. I wasn't really impressed by it either. It is note for note, apart from the beginning. The scenes are, the plot and story and structure unfold identically. The way in which, you know, the sort of like there's scenes that are doppelganged, you know, in terms of like camera angle and camera shot, for that matter. It's not I'm not suggesting it's a shot for shot remake along the lines of Gus Van Sant's Psycho or anything. It's not that. But in terms of structure, they're like cinematic doppelgangers there, and the thing is, then it's like, well, then why exactly do it? I mean, I agree with Mike, but I agree with Rob that's a rhetorical question that never really has an answer. But in the tradition of Carpenter doing The Thing or Cronenberg doing The Fly or whatever, I mean, reimaginings, revisionings, this added nothing. You know, it was nicely shot. They changed the location from Costa del Sol to Mexico, though, which seemed to be really bizarre for me. I didn't understand why that was. And without the first 25 minutes to bring us into this couple's life, their lives, like Mike and I were talking about earlier, we spend an evening or more with Tom and Evelyn, and we get to really kind of like identify with them as a couple on the sunny holiday, coming to grips with this kind of unwanted pregnancy and sort of restating their love for one another and happy to have another child, you know. And you get none of that in the remake. I mean, basically it just starts with them, you know, partying and looking for a boat.
well, like you were saying, it's movie-okey. It's basically karaoke of a film is what it is. And to me, what you're talking about there is exactly the problem that I've talked about on the show many times about modern filmmaking versus something, like I said, not even that old, 30 years ago or almost 40 years ago, where you can have quiet, you can have these scenes of just people hanging out and talking. Doesn't seem like it's really moving the plot along, but what it really does is it builds character. It builds your emotional interest in these people so that when the thing happens that's going to happen, you actually care, as opposed to it just being about the fright, how much gore and blood we can spurt out, you know, how nasty we can make the kills, which seems to be all that modern horror films have been relying on for about the last 15 years or so.
Obviously, since I wasn't seeing a whole lot of difference between this version and the older version, I was really trying to look for what was different between the two. You know, there, to me, there had to be something that the director was trying to say that was, you know, some sort of update or some sort of difference in there. So I was really kind of, you know, stretching for that. And one of them, of course, is that our Tom character, of course, they had to change the names, which I didn't necessarily understand, but the Tom character can speak Spanish. His wife cannot. So there's this kind of like removal of her from the proceedings a little bit. She becomes a little bit outside of everything. She can't even understand what is necessarily being said in a lot of different scenes.
Good point.
So I don't necessarily know why that was. And she's already different because she's much more pregnant in this one than she was in the original. In the original, like, I kept forgetting that Evelyn was pregnant. In this one, there's no mistaking it because she is far along in the pregnancy with this one. So I don't necessarily know what he was trying to say, though, with adding that kind of difference and taking her out of it, unless it was this whole idea of, you know, she becomes a little bit more dispensable in that way, you know, because the Tom character is more involved in the action. He's not, quote unquote, hampered by pregnancy. He's not hampered by a language difference. He can interact much more readily than she can. I felt like she was kind of being cheated a little bit. You had mentioned, Nick, that the performances were good. I was okay with them. I wasn't really with her when it came to, as you said, the reverse abortion. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, I'm not buying that she's terrified or in pain nearly as much as I did with the real. Yeah, exactly. And it was kind of tough to watch that one because it was just, it felt a little clunky in parts to me.
Yeah, I agree. She's kind of one note.
Right, exactly. The other big difference, what you were saying, Rob, was the quiet that we got with the original. There is a score there. It's used very effectively in the original one. In the remake, it really felt like the director was trying to go for a Gaspar Noé kind of feel to his thing. Between the credits, those kind of big, bold, you know, sans serif credits. The one name thing, because I think Noé will sometimes sign his films just that way. And then that kind of like brown noise score that they had going on throughout the whole thing. And it was just like, okay, I don't necessarily see why that is. It's obviously it's not authentic to the location. And it was just this kind of background thing that was supposed to increase our tension, I guess, but really didn't do it for me. Like, I think moments of quiet in this case would be much more tension filled than having that kind of ever present score.
Come out and play. I had mentioned earlier that I did think the performances were good. Primarily him. I don't know that actor's name. Iban. I remember seeing him in Damages, the Glenn Close network show, and I was pretty impressed with him in that. And I just thought there was, you know, I thought he was earnest and sort of giving it his all. The scene, but you know, cumulatively, but as a couple between the two films, there's really no comparison. Like Rob said, those moments of quiet are building great empathy for Tom and Evelyn in the first film. We come to empathize with them and their situation. And so when they're put in harm's way for, you know, no logical reason, we're right there with them, and we also, as the spectators, are confused and angry and hurt. And in the remake, since we don't have much time to get to know them, I was talking to somebody who hadn't seen the original, and they saw the remake, and they thought it was good, but they enjoyed it because of just the basic, the dramatic thrust of it. sort of like, you know. But when I asked them if they identified with the characters very much, they said no. You know, I mean, they identified with their situation, but they didn't really care about them as people.
And that seems to be like one of the things I've seen a lot in modern horror film. I think that is sort of the take of the quote unquote torture porn, be it Saw, be it, you know, Hostel, things like that, is we don't really empathize with the characters as much. It's all about the scenario. It's like, oh, that scenario is fucked up. I could imagine myself being in that scenario, you know, where instead of going, wow, I really care about these characters, plus the scenario is fucked up, which to me is really good. Like, that's what you really want. And talking about sort of this modern remake kind of thing where it just lacks dynamics. I remember, and this is going to go off on a tangent a little bit, but I think it's going to come back to it, is I was reading Tony Iommi's autobiography. He's the guitarist for Black Sabbath. And he was talking about how on the records, he didn't put – they when they stacked the tracks, they didn't put all these fast and heavy tracks right up against each other. If you listen to them, they'll have like this little acoustic bit, or there'll be this slow part, and then it'll come back. And he goes, the whole idea is to build the tension that way, you know, so that that way if you just give it all the time, there's no dynamic and you don't get those shocks. You don't get that up and down. You don't get the dynamics. And I think that that's part of the problem with this film, and also with a lot of, like I said, a lot of modern horror right now. It just lacks dynamics. It's not willing to take the time to develop the characters. It's not willing to have those quiet moments. It's not willing to just have dialogue with just two people talking that doesn't really, like I said, doesn't really seem to always move the plot forward.
That begs the question then, Rob. What in the hell were they thinking? If they're going to do, as Mike suggested, a beat-for-beat remake, basically, why cut the first 20 minutes, which amounts to sort of cinematic oxygen for this film? It allows us to breathe and have those moments and to let cinema just be cinema, to bring us into the setup of the whole thing. They kind of just, like you said, they started with them drinking and boom, let's get on a boat, you know, and it was like and get directly to the sort of plot point. The end of the first it's as if the remake starts at the end of Act One and in the original film and just throws them right into the conflict of Act Two without any setup, and which goes to your point about, you know, why must we have sort of constant bombardment, you know, scene after scene after scene? Why can't we just take a breath and sort of like allow ourselves to suture ourselves into the film itself? And that's why the remake, I'm not saying it did or didn't work for me. It was really a bizarre scenario. I really wasn't expecting what I got. If I were to really sort of bottom line it, what I got was Acts 2 and 3 of the first film. That's what Come Out and Play is. It's without, and that's really kind of what it boils down to for me is here's Acts 2 and 3 of Who Can Kill a Child, go make a film.
Now, in the early part, I said that if there was an American edit of this movie, if there was, you know, they bought it and they were going to put it out in the States on video, they would cut the first 10 minutes off. They'd get rid of the credit sequence. Do you know if there were different edits of this film? And maybe this guy only saw that edit of the film, and that's the reason, and that's the reason why it turned out the way it did. I don't know.
Probably not. I mean, Spain was notorious for their board of censorship. So in Spain, for example, under a dictatorship, violence was not only okay, it was encouraged. Sex was the problem. So they always had two cuts. They had the domestic cut emphasized violence and de-emphasized sexuality, unless, of course, it was a rape. And then that was fine. That was encouraged, actually. There's a very interesting story about that I relate in the book. So you always had these two cuts, and of course the international cut was filled with as much violence and nudity and sex as were permissible. But when you're dealing with a military dictatorship that is in league and in bed with the Catholic Church, you've got troubles when it comes to sex. So I mean, in the films, sex was only to be, you know, hinted at in terms of marriage. If there was any sort of like romantic love, it had to be between a man and a wife, and it would never shown ever. You know, there's no bedroom scenes or anything like that. It was just implied that they were, you know, God-loving, God-fearing couple that were married. But the international cuts, hell yeah. So, but I think to your point, yeah, I'm sure the film was definitely chopped up, but the guys who remade this, they've had access to the original cut for a long time. So I'm sure they saw it. They had to have. I can't really put my finger on. I mean, we're all narrative junkies when it comes right down to it. As long as there's darkened theaters telling us stories, film will still be relevant. The question then is, like, why cut the first act of this film and just start it from when things get going? Is it attention deficit theater? Is that what it is? They're worried that they're going to lose people if we spend a little time with this couple? That doesn't make any sense.
You know, when you do a remake, you should probably raise the stakes. You know, that's one of the rules, you know, or a good rule of thumb, at least. And with this one, they didn't really raise the stakes. I mean, again, when I was watching this, a lot of the violence is implied, which was actually kind of refreshing, rather than it being this kind of, you know, oh, let's, you know, put this guy's eyeball on a fork kind of thing. It was definitely not as violent as it could have been, or there was more of this implied violence. I think there were a couple shots where I was just like, yeah, this is definitely going above and beyond what we had in the original, but not to the point of excess. But then I have to say, you know, we talked about the opening, that they cut that, but then, and I'm not going to give away the ending, but I have to say that the ending, I don't think was nearly as effective with the way that they shot it. And one of the things is that they didn't have enough kids on this island. Yeah. Like, you know, if we're going to compare this to The Birds, like, there were an infinite number of birds in Alfred Hitchcock's movie. Not an infinite number of children on the island in the original film, but there's definitely a very limited number of children in the remake. Right. And you would think that they would have said, you know, okay, well, we're going to set this someplace where there are more children, or at least an equal number of children. So it was very strange when, you know, he's able to mow down all but like a few. And it's like, what? And then, but yet there are more later on. It's like, this doesn't really add up to me, because that was the thing with the original, was that you never really kind of got a real feel for how many kids are there. Right. And you never knew when you turned the corner, are you going to see one kid? Are you going to see a whole bunch of kids? And that was one of the things that really kept you hopping. So that they didn't raise the stakes either, I had a problem with. I also had a problem with this whole thing of the mystery director. I don't know if you guys read up on this Makhnov guy who allegedly directed the film while he was wearing a mask.
Yes.
So I did a little research, and one of our fine listeners came forward and even gave me backup research and everything to let me know that the guy who directed it is Gerardo Naranjo, and who is now set to do, or already in the process of doing, a remake of Death Wish. So I'm hoping that he may have learned from his mistakes with Come Out and Play and might actually do a better remake of Death Wish, but I'm not really getting my hopes up on this one.
Nor am I. You know, that's Michael Winner. That's, you know, that's sacred territory. The original Paul Kersey, Death Wish, Bronson. And I mean, I'm just a little concerned about that now that I know that he's going to be helming it. Just because, yeah, I think we're all in agreement. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, but we all had the exact same reaction to this remake, which was, yeah, it's nicely shot. You know, it's competently done. It's just like, what's the point? It, like we ask of many remakes these days, is like, you're not really adding anything new. You're not retelling the story. You're not making it contextually relevant to today in any way, shape, or form that it wasn't 40 years ago. What the hell's your point? And why did you lop off the first act?
Well, but the point is that the folks in the other film they had bad hair and they were wearing funny clothes. And kids today will not watch movies where people have bad hair and funny clothes.
Having that like 3 or 4 day growth of stubble is okay, but having like an actual manly mustache, that's not cool.
Porn stash.
Yeah, the porn stash that Tom was rocking.
And
yeah.
Yet, as I told you guys in the very beginning at the head of the show, what, you know, why Spanish horror? Of course, in 1976, I spent the entire summer in Spain. And so for me, the film is a very potent sort of nostalgia cocktail as well. Because when I see those shots at the beach, I've got pictures of me in 1976 at the beach in Spain. So
With a porn stash.
With the porn stash, yeah.
It's only like 10 years old, but he's wearing the porn stash, yeah.
So for me, it's potent potent nostalgia when I look at the film from the 70s, you know. It just I lived that summer that they're having, you know. Well, I mean, you know. Literally lived that summer, Godling, but you know, just figuratively speaking, I was there. So
there were some adults that were in the way. There were some bodies involved, bodies, a few deaths. Yes. It's funny that we're talking about remakes and everything and these kind of killer children movies, because I'm reminded of another remake that I don't think really did very much or very well, which was the Village of the Damned remake that John Carpenter did. Definitely didn't bring the power that he did when it came to the Thing remake, which I think, you know, we've actually brought up several times on this show when we talk about effective remakes of previous films, that The Thing is definitely up there, The Thing, The Fly, and a few others. But yeah, Children of the Damned, Village of the Damned, whichever one of the Damned, which I can only picture Christopher Reeve really concentrating hard and picturing a brick wall in his mind. That's the only thing I remember from that movie other than creepy kids. So guys, what are some of the other creepy kid movies that came to mind while you're watching this one? Rob, I'll start with you.
Well, the one that came to me was obviously the Children of the Corn and its various, you know, sequels and offshoots. And it's probably about 37 of those, right? Correct? Like The Howling?
That's what Josh Hadley said. Yeah, I didn't know that there was even a part two. But yeah, apparently maybe that's what you can do with Josh, is do that kind of like Children of the Corn series with him.
You can do Children of the Corn and Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, and then right. That way we can cover all the vegetables. But the one that came to mind for me, and this was just because I'm familiar with the Troma catalog, obviously, is there was a film that Troma put out that was from the late 80s called Beware Children at Play. And it's about like killer kids, like kids start killing their parents and stuff like that. And it's been 15 years since I've seen it, but it was one that sort of reminded me in a way of this, although I would say that Who Can Kill a Child is much better than Beware Children at Play. But you know, if you can see it for free somewhere or rent it, it might be worth a hoot.
Hey, if it's a Troma film, it might be available on YouTube.
There you go.
You know, this is kind of a cheat in some ways. It's not exactly a killer kid. I'll tell you what, while I was watching it, the remake the other day, I think maybe it's because I was watching the remake and not the original, I suddenly thought of Trick or Treat, you know, the Michael Dougherty anthology film, where in a couple of the stories you have, well, in one of the stories is more like high school age kids, but you may recall the grade school kids. And did you guys see Trick or Treat? It's a very clever, nicely done anthology from about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's got one of the stories in it deals with, you know, grade school kids and then the school bus. And anyhow, listeners would definitely know what I'm talking about if they've seen it. It's a night. There's a good creepy kid thing going on in there.
I was also reminded as we were watching this one of the, and I know this is only one kid, but the really creepy kid that was in Twilight Zone.
Sure.
In the what's that one, that the Joe Dante one. So yeah, he was super, super creepy. It also reminded me of that old Star Trek episode where they find all the kids on the planet, and they're
Herbert.
Oh God, those kids are just, yeah. And I always forget that Michael J. Pollard is on there whenever he's in anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
And isn't what's her face from True Grit? She's
Kim Darby,
yep. and Michael J. Pollard. Yeah, I haven't seen that episode in quite some time, but that is what is the name of that episode? Do we know?
That one is just called Miri, MIRI.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was I had to look it up, and I'm just like Star Trek kids. it took a little while before I was able to find what the name of it was, but yeah, it was that one. I was used to just creep me the hell out when I was a kid. So yeah, those are the ones. And then yeah, Children of the Corn, which apparently came out, the book of it came out right around the time that Who Can Kill a Child came out. So coincidence?
Good question. Maybe Stephen King was out late one night and caught a drive-in of Who Can Kill a Child.
You caught know? A midnight show.
Midnight show. It'd be appropriate.
Exactly.
We're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show. I can't wait.
Life to live over.
It's out of the question.
Oh, I know. I was just saying that if I did have my life to live over,
what would you do?
I would live a life filled, engulfed, consumed by lust.
You would?
Yes.
Engulfed.
Consumed.
With lust?
Yes.
Through that door.
Watch me, I can get off. We'll get off together. I've done everything that I've been taught. Doesn't that count for anything?
I'm sure you've pleased the master, but nothing can change. Ever.
That's right. We'll be back next week with our special Devil's Night release of The Devil and Miss Jones. Keep the kids at home and cozy up to a podcast rather than setting Detroit on fire again. We'll be joined by our friend Jill Nelson and talking to Miss Jones herself, Georgina Spelvin, all about this diabolic and classic adult film. Before we go, I want to thank this week's special guest, Nick Schlegel, for joining us in the projection booth. In addition to your working on a book and teaching at EMU, Eastern Michigan University, you're also the co-host of the That's a Wrap podcast. So why don't you tell folks about what they can expect when they listen to That's a Wrap?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. That's a Wrap is very much modeled after the projection booth in many ways. Our point was to sort of like I have two colleagues of mine who also have PhDs in film studies, so we wanted to try and elevate the discourse above that of just, you know, saying I like this movie, I hated this movie sucked, this movie was great, right? Because after all, we all do that anyhow, and we thought if people are going to invest their time and listen to this, perhaps it should be, you know, entertaining but also educational. So we bring some of that mentality to it as well. And we typically interview a lot of authors. You know, we bring in professors, some pretty well-known scholars in their field, as well as authors and historians. And then sometimes we just, the three of us get into, we'll find a particular topic and go on that. But it's a lot of fun. It's been a real pleasure to do. And, you know, I hope listeners will drop by and give it a shot.
It sounds like we have some competition, Rob, for being the most erudite podcast out there.
Well, I think because of that, we're going to have to now edit Nick completely out of this episode.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot, guys. What about the plug for my book? No. Oh, jeez.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about that. Tell us about the book.
The book is called Sex, Sadism, and Spain. And it chronicles the Spanish horror film from 1968 to 1977 in very much the way that we discussed it tonight. And it's sitting with the press right now and should see publication in 2014.
So we will be sure to let folks know when they can go out and pick up a copy.
And, of course, we'll have links and all that information over at our website, projection-booth.com. Want to thank Nick again for coming on the show. If you want to pay it forward, like I said, head over to the website, projection-booth.com, where you have links where you can buy Who Can Kill a Child, Come Out and Play, a link over to the That's a Wrap podcast, and also you'll find the donate button. And maybe, you know, send us a little cash to help develop our very own Projection Booth app. Think about it. All the great stuff that you get each and every week from the Projection Booth, isn't that worth maybe, I don't know, $1 an episode, $2 an episode? Who knows? Just check out the donate button and you can help us on the way to the Projection Booth app. And remember, that's kind of the wave of the future, don't you know?
So I guess those people that have been listening since day one, would kind of owe us $138 by the time this episode comes out.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
Well, you know, if that's what they got to do, then that's what they got to do. The great thing about Michigan is the 10-cent bottle return deposit. Unlike here in Colorado that we do not have, which is amazing because it's a green state, that they do not have a bottle deposit. So there's no excuse for you to go out, you know, go out and pick up 10 cans off the street, you Detroiters, if you happen to be around there, and then mail us that dollar through the donate button there.
Exactly.
You guys are so good at this. My God.
God told me to skin you alive.
Ever wanna die? Of course you have. But I won't till I get my revenge. I've been fucked by fun too many ways. But I don't wanna see people anymore. Things I never ever saw before. But it's even for the shit they are. Things that is, I get away with me. Anyone gonna change for a day? So I kill children. I love to see them die. I kill children. And make them always cry. I kill children. I make them hissing doors. I kill children. Yeah!